This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 66 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frueling. Today, we'll be discussing epistemology, or the theory of knowledge, and the issue of expanding knowledge in the Star Trek universe. Zachary, how are you today, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing okay. It's been a busy work week so far, but it's always nice to sit down and talk some Star Trek.
We always say this is a fun thing that we get to do during the week, and it's always a privilege to sit down and talk Star Trek and philosophy with you. I want to read something, Zachary, to kind of kick off today's episode, again, where we're talking about expanding knowledge in the Star Trek universe. And I want to ask a very broad, fundamental question. First of all, this that I'm going to read is going to be very familiar to everyone who listens to our show. In fact, people who aren't familiar with our show and really don't know a whole lot about Star Trek will be able to recognize these words. They are space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before. And of course, that is the opener for the original series. Star Trek The Next Generation had the same thing with a couple of tweaks. Instead of 5-year mission, it was continuing mission. And then, of course, to boldly go where no man has gone before was a little bit more PC in the Next Generation generation, and they changed that to where no one has gone before. And Zachary, my question is, what business do we have traipsing around the galaxy, exploring places, sticking our noses in where it doesn't belong?
Well, I think as Star Trek fans, we tend to take the Star Trek universe for granted, its fundamental assumptions and worldview and overall ethos. Basically, what you're saying there seems to be that expanding knowledge, you know, going out into the universe, you know, going into the unknown, adventuring, learning what we can learn is intrinsically valuable, that is worth the effort. And I don't think that's obvious at all. In fact, there are races inside the Star Trek universe that don't do that. They're isolationists. They stay on their planet and they worry about social issues in their own world. So it's not obvious that approach, the human approach that's depicted in the Star Trek universe, is the right approach. And we as Star Trek fans, I think, aren't always critical of that worldview. We tend to accept it. We tend to take it for granted. But I think it's worth asking these really deep underlying assumptions. What's so great about knowledge that justifies this massive effort that we see inside the Star Trek universe to leave our own home world, leave our own solar system, and get out there in the galaxy?
You mentioned species that aren't necessarily as driven with their sense of exploration. And that seems to be something that, at least in the Star Trek universe, we find is very unique in many ways to humanity, to the Federation, this idea that we have to continually expand our knowledge. And that seems to be the whole driving purpose for this fleet of vessels out there exploring the galaxy, exploring the universe. In fact, here, these words that I just read really give us the premise for the show. And the show is about the exploration of the universe and the intrepid journeys of the Starship Enterprise. And of course, we added to that over the course of the last almost 51 years. We added Deep Space Nine, where we're exploring the Gamma Quadrant, and we added Star Trek Voyager, where Captain Janeway is stranded with Voyager out there in the Delta Quadrant. And it's, in fact, it tends to be a sticking point occasionally, that on their journey to get back home, they seem to stop at, you know, every gaseous anomaly they can find and launch a probe and do some exploration. So that seems to be, you know, a sticking point there. And it's the driving driving purpose for, you know, the show, for the Star Trek universe, for the Federation. But then when we meet the Vulcans in Enterprise, they're a bit more passive about exploration. They don't get out, you know, too much, and they have rules about the places they explore. And, you know, that's very strange for Captain Archer, who's just eager to get out there and check out what he can see out there in the expanding universe with his Warp 5 ship.
Well, I think you can always ask this deep critical question, what's so great about knowledge in the first place? I mean, yes, if you learn something about the natural world, you can cure diseases and create social progress, all the things that are part of this utopian vision of the future that we see inside the Star Trek universe. But you can also look at the flip side of the coin. Getting out there and exploring the galaxy is dangerous, first of all, right? You know, you take a lot of risk when you get out there and do that. Mm-hmm. If you're on that starship, you might pay for it with your life. You might cause 1,000 people their lives if you're captain of a galaxy-class starship. So there's a lot of risks involved. And frankly, a lot of evil has been done in the name of science. I mean, just look at issues in research ethics and medical ethics. Look at what the Nazis did in the name of research during World War II. You know, there's knowledge itself is, we tend to think of it as intrinsically valuable. Like it's worth the effort. You know, we get some good from the effort, regardless of the risks, regardless of the dangers, regardless of bad consequences that might happen. The knowledge is worth those risks and worth the effort. But I think it's very easy to forget all the terrible things that have been done in the name of science at the same time. So, I'm not necessarily advocating that we should abandon our utopian vision of the future, but I think we don't do science a service when we fail to acknowledge the risks and the dangers and the evils that have oftentimes been associated with it.
I agree. And by asking the question, I hope, you know, I wonder sometimes when I ask these questions, if our listeners are going, geez, what's Morrison talking about?
Are you guys even Star Trek fans?
Yes, absolutely. And
I think we are.
By asking the question, I'm not questioning Star Trek. I'm not questioning the Star Trek universe or the mission of Starfleet. But I think it's a question, again, when we explore these fundamental principles of philosophy, I think it's important to ask and answer these questions and draw conclusions and push the boundaries of our own personal understanding, and even at times question what we believe is truth. And I think there's something very healthy about that. So by no means asking the question, are we saying that we disagree with the mission of Starfleet, we disagree with the Federation. We're just asking some questions here, and hopefully we come up with a few answers along the way. But as we oftentimes say, at least in Star Trek, we ask more questions than we answer.
Well, there are so many related questions here when it comes to knowledge. I think first and foremost, you can ask, what is the value of knowledge? Is it intrinsically valuable, or does it have purely instrumental value? Is it valuable because it allows us to solve problems and create utopias and cure diseases? Is that why knowledge is valuable? Or even if knowledge leads to none of those things, is the quest for knowledge itself intrinsically valuable in some way? So that's one question, the value of knowledge. Another question would be the nature of knowledge. What exactly constitutes genuine knowledge? And the final question I think that's related would be the practical questions. What are the mechanics of going about generating that knowledge, whatever it is and whatever its value is?
As you mentioned a moment ago, I think the general attitude that we have as human beings is that knowledge has in itself intrinsic value. And for instance, in our own space race, let's pull out of the Star Trek universe for a moment and, you know, come back to our personal
reality.
Our own space race, you know, we made some mistakes along the way, and people lost their lives in those early missions and the not so early missions. You know, in my lifetime, I've seen two shuttle accidents that claimed lives. And, you know, we can go back to the early Apollo missions, and even before that, the Mercury missions. I mean, we were taking great risks, and people got hurt, people died. But we always pushed forward with this understanding that the quest for knowledge was intrinsically valuable and it was worth the sacrifice.
Mike, I'm wondering what our overall perception of the intrinsic value of space exploration would be had the space program not been as successful as it has been. You mentioned a couple of space shuttle disasters. I'm thinking of Apollo 1, where the capsule caught on fire on the launch pad, those kinds of cases. But those are really isolated instances. Generally, the space program has been successful. I mean, look at how many launches there have been, how many astronauts have gone into space, the places we've gone into orbit and to the moon and whatnot. And it's overall a success. You know, if most of those had been failures, would we be as willing to say that it was worth the risk? I don't know. It's a counterfactual question, and those are always hard to answer. Yeah. We don't really know, yeah. Right? But I think we would have a slightly less optimistic view of it had we had all of those experiences.
Yeah, and I should mention, you know, before the space race, we had just this development post-World War II where we were developing jet engines and we were going faster than the speed of sound. And how many test pilots lost their lives testing these experimental aircrafts, and all in this push to expand the reaches of our own grasp, you know, to get beyond the boundaries of our stratosphere.
Pilots going Mach 2 with their hair on fire.
quite literally.
I think there's a personality type associated with that, right? A risk taker, someone who's not well grounded, someone who doesn't care as much about what's going on the ground and has their head a bit in the clouds, right? And I mean, can you look at the entire Star Trek universe and say, oh God, all these characters in the Star Trek universe just have their head in the clouds. They're not grounded. They're not focusing on what's happening today. They're not focusing on solving problems back on Earth. They're so worried about going out into the galaxy that they're forgetting about the things that really matter here for the rest of us. Just to ask the really deep critical question, like, is it really so worth it? Or, you know, is Captain Kirk a bit more like a test pilot with this going Mach 2 or Warp 8 with his hair on fire? Warp 13.
Warp 13.
I mean, it's undeniable that exploration and the expansion of knowledge produces some good, right? I guess there are two perspectives you can take. One is like this pure instrumentalist utilitarian perspective. Like, does it produce so much good that it outweighs all the risks, right? It's almost a cost and benefit, pros and con kind of analysis. And then the other question is, you know, if knowledge doesn't just have instrumental value, if it has intrinsic value, then are we willing to keep taking those risks to get that intrinsic value, even knowing all the terrible things that could ensue, all the dangers? Do we really think knowledge is worth it, even if none of those good effects were to come to fruition?
You know, it's funny because as we're sitting here talking about this, Zachary, my mind is going to one of my favorite movies about the space race, and that is The Right Stuff. And when I think about The Right Stuff, I think about one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek, honestly, is an Enterprise episode entitled First Flight. And of course, this is the fundamental foundational episode that really talks about the development of that Warp 5 engine. And there was a bit of a competition going on between Jonathan Archer and his friend A.G. Robinson to be, you know, really out there, that, you know, to get that captaincy of that first Warp 5 ship. And there was a conversation going on as these two men were competing. It was a friendly competition, but it was still a pretty heated competition. And
I think I saw there was a Captain Morrison in the running there for a while.
Yeah. There's this conversation going on between Robinson and Archer. And Robinson says to Archer, "You want to talk about taking risks? You're a great pilot, maybe as good as me, but you're never going to get out into deep space by playing it safe." What a mindset.
Okay, but I feel like we have to step back and ask, is this really is this really the motivation we need for going out into the galaxy? Is it purely about risk-taking, making a name for yourself? Yes, it's grandiose. We do tend to respect the hero figures, but that sounds awfully self-focused and inwardly driven rather than for some grand cause or for, you know, forwarding the human species or, you know, this is to make a name for yourself.
Sure it does. But I think that we have to address the fact that there are risks involved with exploration. The exploration of the oceans come with risk. The exploration, you know, just going back into our own history at a time when popular science of the day said the Earth was flat. And, you know, I'm thinking of the Pillars of Hercules, you know, there'd be dragons beyond this point. And, you know, they believed that ships would literally fall off the edge of the Earth. And, you know, we pushed those boundaries and we took some risks. And, you know, next thing you know, Columbus, you know, makes some circumnavigation and he finds the Indies. And so we've got a whole strange new world here.
Don't even get me started on the risks associated with starting a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Talk about career suicide.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I still get funny looks occasionally when I tell people that, you know, I talk about Star Trek and philosophy there. But there are risks involved. And for the Star Trek universe, Enterprise, I think, not as much as it could have, but Enterprise really kind of highlights the nature of those risks that were involved, especially, you know, with this first Warp 5 ship going out into deep space. You know, I'm reminded of something that Trip Tucker says in Anomaly. He says, every species we run into seems to be gunning for us. There are dangers out there. There are things out there in space, alien species aside, that we don't understand, that we barely know exist, and we're going out there, and again, we're going to be traipsing out through the galaxy exploring these things. There are going to be risks involved, and we've proven that at every phase of our own personal development as a species, as we've explored the other side of our globe, as we've explored the deep oceans, as we've gone into, you know, to flight, and as we've expanded beyond our own stratosphere, there have been risks along the way, and those risks have cost lives. But the knowledge that we've gained as a species, again, I can say, has, you know, just the benefits really outweigh the risks involved.
Well, let me ask the question to you in a slightly different way. If the value of knowledge in the Star Trek universe is not purely instrumental, if we don't pursue the goal of exploring the galaxy and gaining increased knowledge for the sake of achieving some goal or some end or some utopian society. In other words, if knowledge is intrinsically valuable, like worth it, even if none of those positive effects come to fruition, even given all the dangers, it's valuable in itself. What exactly accounts for that intrinsic value? I mean, lots of things in human life don't have intrinsic value. Like right now, I own a house, right? I don't think that has intrinsic value. Mm-hmm. It works for me. It doesn't work for other people. There's nothing intrinsically important about owning a house, right? What's so intrinsically valuable about gaining increased knowledge? What accounts for the difference between something important but mundane or important but not in, you know, not having intrinsic value, and knowledge being so important that we're willing to say that it has intrinsic value despite all the dangers and despite the risk of none of those positive effects coming into fruition?
You know, I think first of all about the medical knowledge that we've gained. Again, just looking at our own exploration.
Well, see, I got to stop it because you're sounding awfully instrumental there. Like you're about to say, well, we get a lot of good out of it. and that's not intrinsic value. True. That's instrumental value, right?
True. Yeah. So I think that's a very difficult question to answer because I can think of lots of instrumental reasons intrinsically.
Oh, we could come up with 100 if we gave ourselves 10 minutes to do it.
Exactly.
But,
exactly.
Yeah, but I guess the question is, if you bracket all of that, you know, you say, okay, knowledge gives us increased, you know, medical benefits. Well, you go, well, suppose that didn't happen. That's what it means to have intrinsic value. Like, even if that doesn't happen, knowledge is still valuable in itself. So if you bracket all of these instrumental concerns, all the benefits that we get from knowledge, what then makes knowledge valuable to us if we bracket everything instrumental? I think it's a really difficult question. I don't have an obvious answer to it.
It is. It is.
Because you're almost immediately thrown back into the practical value. Well, knowledge binds us together as a society, or knowledge solves medical problems, or knowledge solves social problems, or knowledge, you know, makes for a great time down there in engineering. I don't know. but it's some sort of benefit, right? If we can avoid the talk of benefits altogether, what else? What are we left with? I mean, I do think there's something to this idea that there are risk takers and we tend to admire them. It's in the realm of virtue ethics where we sort of think of this as a human virtue, being willing to step outside of your comfort zone and go into the unknown. We idolize those people. Mm-hmm. We wish we could be more like that sometimes, considering our relatively mundane existences. I think we value that as a virtue. So, you know, even if none of the benefits to knowledge occurred, do we value the mere act of stepping out as a personal human virtue, whether or not it results in something good?
Yeah, and there's no obvious answer for that. Again, as I sit here and I mull over what has been gained through our exploration of space, I just keep coming up with instrumental benefits and nothing really intrinsic.
I mean, look at the captains of the various ships in the Star Trek universe. You know, they've taken the weight of responsibility for other people's lives and even for the Federation as a whole, and they've put it squarely on their own shoulders. Mm-hmm. They can't pass the buck. They can't say, oh, it's the Admiral's fault back there on Earth. They're on the front lines making all the decisions, and it rests right on their shoulders. I think there's something valuable about being willing to accept that much responsibility for your life, the lives of others, for the world at large, the galaxy in the Star Trek universe. You know, whether or not good things come of that, there's something to be said for just having the chutzpah, for lack of a better word, to sit down in that chair.
Yeah. And Captain Pike wrestled with this in the original pilot of Star Trek. Captain Kirk wrestled with that in the original series. I think Captain Janeway wrestled with that in Voyager. In fact, she wrestled probably more than any other captain in the Star Trek universe with the responsibility and the weight of her own decisions.
So if we follow this line of reasoning, that the intrinsic value of going out of the universe to explore has to do with the chutzpah of the captains, let's just entertain that as a hypothesis. What distinguishes that kind of chutzpah, you know, the exploration kind, from the reckless kind going Mach 2 with your hair on fire as a test pilot? What is there? Is there? I mean, because they're structurally similar, right? They both have chutzpah.
Yeah.
But one seems more meaningful than the other for some reason, and one seems more reckless, maybe. Or, and if it's not a test pilot, think of something else reckless, skydiving or something really radically reckless.
Yeah, Zachary, as I frame that within the context of our own space race, I think about Chuck Yeager. And, you know, you talk about, you know, going Mach speed with the hair on fire. You know, here's the guy that really, you know, he was the first to break the land speed record. And he broke the land speed record over and over and over again. And, you know, at one time, you know, he was considered the fastest man alive. And you look at that, but then you look at, say, a John Glenn, who was the first man to orbit the Earth. The personality and the makeup of these two men couldn't be more different. I look at Chuck Yeager as a means to an end. You know, that kind of chutzpah is important in that it leads to that next step and to the next step.
It gets
step
you off the ground until you mature?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we often say if you're going to learn to walk, you must first crawl.
Well, okay, it sounds like in the situation you're describing that those first tentative steps of exploration, literally getting off the ground in this case, mm-hmm. require quite a bit more recklessness that we look at today and we kind of go, wow, that's really reckless. Is that really worth the risk? But as our trajectory into exploration or in outer space matures, even the progression from Enterprise to the original series to the relatively comfortable existence in space that we see in Star Trek The Next Generation, there's a maturity that comes along with that comfort. You don't have to take risks in quite the same way when you have a mature development of exploration, right? You know, the universe we see in Star Trek: The Next Generation is a mature one. You don't need Chuck Yeager's inside Star Trek: The Next Generation. That might have worked in Enterprise. We do need that. Even in the original series, we need a lot more risk taking going out into the final frontier. But, you know, basically, you know, by the time Star Trek: The Next Generation rolls around, you're ferrying diplomats around. So you don't need quite that same type of chutzpah. Although when the proverbial stuff hits the fan, I'd still feel comfortable with Captain Picard taking risks.
Sure. And you know, this is something fun that I find occasionally in Star Trek is this willingness to see these captains reflect back on the Kirk Spock McCoy era. And we find this from time to time in The Next Generation. You know, it was commenting on cowboy diplomacy of someone like Spock. For Captain Janeway, it's talking about Captain Kirk and, you know, these Starfleet types, you know, back in the day would probably be turned out of Starfleet today if they wouldn't have been able to get away with these things. Just kind of reflecting back. And I think there's something very natural about that, because again, as we think back to someone like Chuck Yeager, we think, wow, that guy was nuts. But if there had not been a Chuck Yeager, there would never have been a John Glenn. And if there was no John Glenn, then, you know, fill in the blank. You know, there'd have been no Armstrong. If there was no Armstrong, there never would have been, again, fill in the blank.
So you're basically saying that without Chuck Yeager, we wouldn't have this amazing opportunity to shuttle diplomats around the Federation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you don't want to miss that. So,
and honestly, Zachary, it's one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of the series Enterprise, because when we come to Star Trek, a la the original series, you know, Starfleet is somewhat refined. Obviously, not nearly as refined as The Next Generation. That's one of the beautiful things I think about Next Generation. We tease about the carpeted walls, you know, the Hilton in space. But I think it's natural to expect that in a, you know, nearly 100 years time, you know, the whole nature of Starfleet and the nature of ships and the purpose and the mission, it's all going to be different. It's going to be more refined. It's going to be a little bit more luxurious and a little bit slower pace. But the beautiful thing is, you know, to look at, for instance, Enterprise in the context of the original series, you know, they're basically literally in a submarine out there in the middle of space. It's cramped quarters. It's, you know, the thing's going to fly apart any minute. It's, you know, fragile. As a matter of fact, there are multiple comments about how fragile the NX-01 is by other species. And, you know, for that matter, you know, going and, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, we celebrated First Contact Day, 46 more years to go. I watched, like many Star Trek fans, I watched First Contact, you know, and getting to see the Phoenix and, you know, the grittiness of Zefram Cochrane and just being able to appreciate, you know, how we get from here to there and to just stop for a moment and really reflect even on our own progress and, you know, the grittiness of people like Chuck Yeager and what it took, the bravery, the risks that it took so that we could add to our knowledge, so that we could break out of the confines of our own planet and explore space.
I mean, what you're describing is just another type of instrumental value, though. I mean, being able to have first contact with the Vulcans is a type of social growth, perhaps.
Sure.
It's a maturity of, you know, a growth out of our own local environment into a galactic environment with all the political ramifications and the benefits that come from that. But that's all just instrumental value,
sure,
right? So I'm trying to think of other kinds of intrinsic value that this quest for knowledge or exploration might have. And one thing that came to mind is just this notion of, I'm trying to think of a way to put it, like species authenticity, maybe. Like we're the of all the species here on Earth, maybe with some other intelligent species, we seem to have a greater ability to understand ourselves and the natural world and our place in it and comprehend meaning and who we are and our place in the universe, right? We, at least on our own planet, we seem to have that ability to a greater degree than any other life form, with some other candidates, you know, the higher apes and dolphins and species like that. But we seem to have that ability to a greater degree than even they do, from what we can tell. So you could just say that that's just who we are at a very fundamental level. This is what it means to be human. This is what we're the rational animal, as Aristotle would have put it. We're the being. You know, other beings have other virtues, like dolphins can. Well, let's not use dolphins as an example. Like, other beings have lots of virtues, like take a dog, man's best friend, or Porthos. they're on the NX-01, right? Porthos is, somewhat intelligent. He's loyal. Mm-hmm. If you need something sniffed out, if you lose something, like he's probably, if you lose some cheese, he's good to have around. And that's what it means to be a dog, right? Dogs have those virtues, but understanding their place in the cosmos is not their strong suit, right? But humans have this unique ability to understand ourselves. We're conscious of our own beings and our place in the universe. And we recognize that that's an issue for us. We don't fully understand our place in the cosmos. We understand that there is a cosmos, that it's even a problem in the way that other species and beings just don't seem to even understand that that's a potential issue for them, right? Porthos is not worried about his place in the universe, right? He's content to eat his cheese and hang out with Captain Archer in his ready room. And, that's, Porthos is cool with that. He doesn't seem to wrestle with these deeper existential issues, but humans seem to wrestle with existential issues. We're concerned about ourselves and our place and the meaning of our lives in relation to this cosmos that we partially understand. And that's just who we are. That's part of our innate ability, is to be able to ask those questions. So you could just say, at a very fundamental level, going out and exploring, trying to increasingly understand our place in the cosmos, is maximally authentic as a human being compared to almost every other life form we see here on Earth. And that's intrinsically valuable. I think that's not instrumental. That has nothing to do with benefits that we get from obtaining that knowledge or this increased understanding. This has to do with us being the fullest version of ourselves.
Yeah, and I question if that is really the heart of our own exploration, at least as we see it in our own world today. It seems to me
it might account for the drive, though.
It quite possibly could. And it seems to me like the question that we seem to be trying to answer actively is, are we alone in the universe? Are we alone in the universe? And we do an incredible amount of research on this. We spend a heck of a lot of money on this. We're pointing radio telescopes out into the universe. We're sending signals out. We're launching probes. All in the name of trying to determine, are we alone in the universe? And I understand that there's something intrinsic about this, but it's also can seem instrumental to me.
I don't think that that's the fundamental question, though. I mean, put our imagination hats on. Like, suppose that question were answered tomorrow. Suppose, we point the Arecibo radio telescope to a certain star and boom, there's radio signals there. And we know for sure there's life on another planet. That wouldn't satisfy our existential quest for knowledge, right? So that can't be the fundamental question, because I think the second that question is answered, we're on to what's the next thing? How are we going to get there? How many others are there? Let's still keep building and doing and achieving. And, I don't think that will satisfy our quest to explore.
And then, Zachary, there's this colonial drive that seems to kick in. And we've seen this in our own history, and we explore this to some degree in the Star Trek universe. It seems like we make these discoveries, we plant our flag on some new distant world, and the next thing we need to plant are people. We've got to put people there and build colonies and inhabit, these distant reaches of space. And we do that in the Star Trek universe, I think, for the very reason that we've done it in our own world. I mean, Columbus discovered a new world. Next thing you know, we're loading boats up and, people are coming over here and building colonies.
Well, I think we as humans have this, this is the dark side of our exploration, right? Yes, we explore. We want to increase our knowledge and expand our terrain and understand our place in the cosmos more. But once we get there, we want to make it in our own image. we can't just be happy with it the way it is. We want to turn it into our vision for what things should be.
And this is where I think we get into some of the ethics of exploration and kind of back to my original question, you know, what business do we have out there traipsing around the galaxy exploring? Is it our space to explore? And are we trespassing and sticking our noses in places where it doesn't belong? Or should we limit our exploration this far and no further, as Captain Picard would say?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because you might think that if knowledge is intrinsically valuable, in other words, if the value of knowledge is not dependent on the benefits we derive from it, then there should be no limits, right? That's one approach you could take, that if it's intrinsically valuable, let's go hog wild. Let's just go and explore and do all the experiments we can do. And, you know, if there's some collateral damage along the way, so be it. You might argue that that's one consequence of this idea that knowledge has intrinsic value. On the other hand, you know, I think for our American listeners, I think this language will be really familiar. I'm not sure about people in other parts of the world. Depends where you're from, I guess. But, you know, we here in America, we think certain things are intrinsically valuable. Freedoms to do this, that, and the other thing. But we also think we place limits on that freedom in the language of rights, right? You know, I have certain freedom until I step on someone else's rights. Mm-hmm. And then that places a limit on my freedom. We still think freedom is intrinsically valuable, but we use certain constraining factors to place limits on that freedom. You could think of knowledge as the same way, that knowledge could be intrinsically valuable, but if you're pursuing knowledge at the expense of someone's inalienable intrinsic rights, then you've taken it too far. And that's a limit, placed, or a constraint that's placed on this intrinsic value of knowledge. And I think the Prime Directive serves this function inside the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The Prime Directive serves to constrain the practical actions you can take in pursuit of knowledge, but it doesn't negate the intrinsic value of the pursuit itself.
And we see this happen occasionally in the Star Trek universe. Somebody will stumble into space where they're not welcome. We see this happen to Captain Janeway, immediately comes to mind, as she is trying to plot the best course back to the Alpha Quadrant. Occasionally she stumbles into somebody's space and they say, "We don't want you here. We've heard about you. Go away." And generally, there is an attempt for diplomacy. Hey, we're just passing through. You know, we won't interfere. We won't harm. We're just on our way home. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, the general attitude is, okay, well, we'll have to find another way around without going through their space.
You know, it actually sounds like every once in a while I get solar salesmen coming to my door. They're trying to convince me to buy solar things for my house.
Same here.
And I can't do that because I have a certain kind of roof. It's just not going to work. So this is the situation you're describing. They come to me where they're not wanted. I reject them. They attempt an act of diplomacy. And what happens from there? I end up having to shut the door on them at some point because they continue with their act of diplomacy where they're not wanted. But
Yeah.
So we're basically saying that the Federation are kind of like used car salesmen.
Or solar panel salesmen.
I'm sure there are some wonderful solar panel salespeople out there, but the ones that come to my door leave something to be desired.
Well, you could go the third route. I was going to say, Zachary, the third option in the Star Trek universe. You have diplomacy, you have plot another course, but then you have active conflict. So, you know, next time a solar salesperson comes to your door, if they don't go away, just arm the photon torpedoes.
Yeah, but then I know you're joking, but you're firmly in the realm of violating someone else's rights at that point, right?
Sure, I'm clearly joking.
But that doesn't negate the choice. I mean, you know, the captains always have their finger on the button. They can fire those photon torpedoes whenever they want. You know, the fact that there's a rule or a constraint or a law or a principle doesn't negate the responsibility of having your finger on the button.
And I should say, in all seriousness, although tongue-in-cheek, in the Star Trek universe, those photons usually don't get armed until the species is actively fired on them, in which case, you know, they would be defending themselves. And that's certainly what those armaments are for in the Star Trek universe, strictly for defense.
I guess it's still an interesting question, though. If knowledge is intrinsically valuable, and if, you know, shooting up another starship is the fastest way to learn whatever you're trying to learn, you know, maybe if Captain Picard was willing to do a little archaeological exploration with phasers blasting, right? You know, blast his way to that dig site. you could say that that's justified if knowledge is intrinsically valuable. I mean, I guess you can weigh certain kinds of knowledge versus other kinds of knowledge. If you destroy certain things along the way, then you're losing that knowledge and gaining some other kind of knowledge. So you can do this kind of cost-benefit analysis of different kinds of knowledge in relation to each other. But generally, I think we just say that, like, that knowledge is not worth it if you have to go to the extreme of firing photon torpedoes and blowing up other starships to reach a dig site. That archaeological exploration is not valuable enough to justify the various means you might take to achieve it.
Zachary, it's not in the realm of space exploration, but it sort of sounds to me like we're dancing on something that come up in an episode of Voyager in which the Doctor had to conjure up a program that utilized the knowledge of Krell Moset, who was a Cardassian scientist, in order to save B'Elanna's life. And he makes the decision at the end of the episode to use that knowledge, to use the skill that was in the program, that is, you know, the some knowledge of Krell Moset, to save B'Elanna's life. She's offended by it. And Captain Janeway is willing to live with her decision to make this questionable decision in order to get the knowledge necessary to save B'Elanna. I think we're in that realm here.
This is a really interesting episode. I'm so glad you thought to mention it, because it raises this fascinating question. Is it possible for knowledge to be tainted in some way? Is the historical fact of how that knowledge was achieved somehow relevant to its permissible use today? I'm a little skeptical of this, because you could plausibly say that the Doctor had nothing to do with the experiments that Krell Moset did. Neither did Captain Janeway. Neither did anyone else on Voyager. And now that the knowledge exists, it just exists. It's there. It's available. It's publicly accessible. It's in the database. We can use it, right? Why wouldn't we use that to save B'Elanna's life? But I think the counterargument to that would be that you can always justify your potentially horrendous experiments by citing the potential justification, the potential benefits, the potential good that it might cause down the road someday. So we're fully justified in harming other people here today. So I think the what's really going on in that argument is that, look, if we continue to use this knowledge, all that does is enable other scientists to continue pursuing these kinds of ethically questionable research in the name of future good that will ensue someday, to the point where we're willing to overlook the fact that they've trampled on people's innate rights to achieve that knowledge. But I'm kind of skeptical of this notion that the knowledge itself is tainted. I could see that if we continue to allow that knowledge to be used, then we are kind of enabling other people to continue that kind of ethically questionable research. But I don't know what it means for knowledge itself to be tainted in some way. I'm really skeptical of that line of reasoning.
And that entirely is the ethical dilemma that's presented in that episode, Nothing Human, from Voyager's fifth season. And it's a fascinating series of questions that they ask. And at the end of the episode, again, Catherine Janeway decides that B'Elanna's life is too important to allow the ethical questioning of Moset's methods to prevent her from using that knowledge to save a life. And, you know, when we talk about these kind of medical ethics issues, again, I think we're in the same realm as, be it medical knowledge or the knowledge of space, whatever it is that you're dealing with. I think these ethical issues are really universal in many ways. And I do want to mention, Zachary, that we talked a great deal about medical ethics in Metatrex 51, entitled Dr. Mora's Jello Mold. We talked about scientific and medical ethics. We talked about competing ethical theories on scientific research. We talked about clinical detachment, the ethics of care. A really great episode. If our listeners want to go back into our back catalog and check it out, we really discuss these ethical issues in a tremendous amount of detail.
I think what's interesting about that episode, though, is that it potentially contradicts or at least has a tension with Star Trek's own ethos when it comes to knowledge.
Sure.
I think generally in the Star Trek universe, knowledge is taken for granted. It's taken to be something that's publicly accessible. It's a virtue. The more you can get of it, the better. Right. And now all of a sudden we have this notion of tainted knowledge in comparison with this open source knowledge concept that I think is that the Star Trek universe is largely founded on. Anyone can achieve, whatever they set their mind to. We can achieve greatness. We can learn whatever we want to learn. You know, the limits of our knowledge are endless. We just need to get out in the galaxy and explore. I think that's generally the Star Trek ethos. It's almost like the early days of the internet. The more knowledge, the better. Put it all on the internet. Open source for everyone, right? But now there's this notion of tainted knowledge. Some knowledge that's verboten, you know, impermissible because of its historical antecedents or its historical origin. I think that is in direct contradiction with Star Trek's open source view of knowledge. And I'm trying to think of like other historical antecedents for this notion that some types of knowledge are not open source, aren't publicly accessible, aren't valuable in themselves for everyone or aren't available to everyone for use. I'm thinking of reaching into the Wayback Machine here, I'm thinking of like Gnostic knowledge, you know, this notion that there's a type of secret knowledge that, you know, unless you're part of a certain society mm-hmm. or achieved a certain level, you know, whether it's like Freemasonry or whether it's, you know, Gnostic sects, Neoplatonism and whatnot, is there kind of secret knowledge that exists that's valuable but not accessible to everyone? And we even see a little bit of this in the Star Trek universe, in Voyager in particular, with like the Omega Directive, right? There's some secret knowledge that's not accessible to everyone, but only when you've achieved a certain level do you get sort of privy access to this secret, you know, Gnostic kind of knowledge, the Omega Directive.
I'm glad you thought to mention that. That episode came to mind as you were talking about, kind of this hidden Gnostic knowledge. I've even known of the Christian Church, the Catholic Church, being accused of having these kind of Gnostic secrets that it's, you know, these secrets that aren't common knowledge that they haven't shared with.
I saw the Da Vinci Code, so I know what you're talking about.
indeed.
Sure they do. I saw the Da Vinci Code.
Sure.
I mean, it sounds like what we're seeing, Mike, is that the notion of knowledge that we have at first glance at the Star Trek universe is not necessarily accurate, right? We kind of have this utopian vision that Star Trek is all about knowledge and anyone can advance and anyone can make whatever they want of their lives and, you know, kind of a Encyclopedia Galactica, you know, there in the computer banks on the Enterprise, right? But that's not really how it works. Some types of knowledge is verboten, perhaps, according to the Doctor and Carl Massett and that discussion. We have certain kinds of knowledge that are more like Gnostic knowledge, secret hidden knowledge that you only get access to when you've achieved a certain level. It's not just like political knowledge, right? It's not just like, you know, you have political secrets that you only get access to if you're an admiral. We're talking like laws of physics that aren't made available for public consumption unless you've achieved a certain level. Like the public can't handle this truth about the laws of nature. And that's really weird. That seems like it's in direct opposition to how we think of knowledge in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, Zachary, and it seems to me like, and getting back to the Omega Directive, it seems to me like those are the types of secrets that fuel things like conspiracy theories. And we live in a time when there are so many secrets. There are secrets that I think some of them are necessary. You mentioned military secrets. Those types of secrets are understandable and necessary. Although there are people who say, no, it's actually in the interest of the public to know everything.
Yeah, the whistleblowers and the WikiLeakers and those.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But on the same hand, if you have capabilities or you have intelligence, you don't want, for instance, in a military situation, you don't want your enemy to have access to that. So I understand the nature of some secrets. I understand that a captain of a starship is going to have knowledge that perhaps, you know, a crewman down in engineering just isn't going to have. And I completely get that. But then we go into the realm of, you know, for instance, medical knowledge. You mentioned scientific knowledge, physics, some law of physics that, you know, that we have access to. You know, some people would say, again, getting back to the conspiracy theories and the things that fuel those conspiracy theories, you know, it's often been thought, for instance, that there was more to Area 51 and, you know, our government has knowledge that there's life out there in the universe and we're keeping that knowledge from the public in order to, you know, irony quotes, protect the public. And so it seems to me like these things can fuel conspiracy theories. And I think there were probably some conspiracy theories attached to the Omega Directive. I could sit here and have some fun just sitting here talking about the conspiracy theories that were probably flying around while Janeway was in her ready room reviewing that information.
Well, I think undoubtedly wherever knowledge is not available, that's going to breed conspiracy theories, right? I think that's a given, right? You know, people want to know more. They wonder why they can't. And, you know, people's wheels start spinning. They come up with all kinds of crazy theories. Mm-hmm. I get that. But that seems to me a little different from saying that certain kinds of knowledge are tainted or certain kinds of knowledge are sure. Not just practically not disseminated for political reasons, but intrinsically like the Gnostics would have said, sort of intrinsically secret. Like it's, you only are worthy of the knowledge if you've achieved a certain something, right? If you're right. In the right club, if you have the right background, or if you've, you know, earned your way in the secret society or something like that. You know, that seems, you know, the Omega Directive is a little more like that, right? You're not privy to this knowledge of the natural world until you're a captain or above, you know, sort of a flag rank or above. Or in the case of the tainted knowledge, it's like, no, this is knowledge that we should bury. We should forget about. It shouldn't be made accessible. We should forget that we know this, even if we can save people's lives, because it's you know, tainted. I can't think of a better word than tainted. trying to whip out my thesaurus and think, is there a synonym for tainted? Not that I can think of, not right now. So
it makes me wonder though.
I know I said tainted like 20 times in the last 2 minutes, but
yeah. It makes me wonder, though, if things like Freemasonry still exists in the 24th century. You know, if...
I find that really interesting because literally right over here next to me, not 5 feet away in my podcast studio, is my grandfather's ceremonial Masonic sword with mm-hmm. his name carved in it and whatnot. I have no idea what they do with those swords. I just think it's cool. You know, it's been handed down to me. I like it. You know, I'm sure it was used for some kind of thing that they weren't supposed to talk about back then. And now you can probably Google, like, what the heck do Freemasons do with their swords in dark rooms? But, you know, I don't know off the top of my head, right? It's still kind of Gnostic to me. I haven't kind of earned my way into it and I've never bothered to look it up, so I don't really know. But would that kind of thing persist? I think people love their secrets, though. I mean, we all want to feel special and unique, like we're beautiful, unique snowflakes, that we know something other people don't. Mm-hmm. And I think humans naturally also want to kind of... When they have something other people don't, a certain kind of knowledge, a certain kind of ability, a certain kind of gift, whatever it is, we kind of want to draw a circle around ourselves and say, no, this is mine. This is secret. You can't have it.
I think I've suddenly realized why Riker was so darn cocky strutting around the ship. He was a Freemason.
He didn't want to share all those women.
He had knowledge that nobody else had.
Riker had lots of knowledge other people didn't have. He didn't want to share.
Right next to his trombone was a Masonic sword. I'm telling you, it's.
I'm like, this is Riker. He has knowledge of a lot of things.
So Zachary, back to the issue of ethics. It's not really exploration, but more of the question of mission. I'm thinking of the episode Damage from the third season of Enterprise, the Zindi arc, in which Captain Archer makes what many would consider to be, and again, I'm not saying it was or it wasn't, but many would consider to be a questionable decision to board an alien vessel, phasers blazing, and he takes a warp coil so that he is able to make a meeting with Degra on time. And of course, the Lyrian captain turns and asks him, why are you doing this? And Archer, you know, basically says, you know, I don't have a choice. It's not, again, an issue of knowledge, but it is an issue of ethics. Again, talking about, you know, what are the limits of using power to pursue that knowledge. it wasn't knowledge, but it was mission. I think it's applicable.
There's a little bit of that discussion that strikes me as a cop-out. Archer does have a choice. He doesn't have to do that, right?
Sure.
So, you know, saying he doesn't have a choice kind of, it's dramatic, but it's not probably true, right? He could have come up with something else to do. Could have waited on it for a while. But in general, you know, I think the quest for knowledge and exploration is always like this. You know, for everything you choose to do, you're choosing not to do something else. If you help someone over here, you're not helping someone over there. If you're learning something about this and that's where you spend your resources, you're not learning something about that other thing and you're not spending resources there. If you are doing a certain kind of experiment, you're harming this kind of being, right? We're going to harm white mice and white rabbits and, you know, whatever other kinds of beings we experiment on if we research biology, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's always going to be a trade-off. If not collateral damage, then there's a trade-off, right?
Sure.
And I guess my point is we always have a choice, right? We cannot do those things. And so some things we think of as valuable enough to justify the cost and justify the collateral damage and justify the harming of others or violating their rights, and other kinds of things we don't. And it's not always obvious what's what. I think it's a gigantic line drawing problem. Some things are so bad where we go, oh no, you can't, you know, like Nazi experiments in Nazi Germany, right? That is too far, too much. We're not willing to go there. That's a clear violation mm-hmm. of people's rights. And then there's a lot of things where we go, yeah, that's pretty harmless. You know, if you're researching, you know, if you build a submarine and go down in the ocean and you just want to stare at the fish, right? And you're doing some kind of passive research. There's not a lot of cost there, right? You're not harming very much. You're just kind of passively observing. So no big deal. That's the other end of the spectrum. But most other kinds of experiments and most other kinds of decisions are in the middle. And it's a big line drawing problem. I don't think there's a way around it. We can talk about people's rights or the rights of other beings. We can talk about pros versus cons, the benefits versus the costs. And I don't know if there's another way to talk about it other than to say, ultimately, it rests on us what we decide to value and what we decide not to value. And if Captain Archer says, you know, violating this other, you know, ship captain's rights and stealing their warp coil is worth it because of this other thing, you know, we can say, is he wrong? You know, he violated someone's rights. He's all of a sudden stealing, and that's not very Federation-like, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, it's up to him to decide, what do I value and what do I not value? I don't think principles get you off the hook, no matter which way you spin it, on either side of that spectrum.
No, and you were talking about tainted knowledge, and I think at the end of the day for Captain Archer, you know, in the fourth season, third episode, entitled Home, there are some questions raised at the
he's got
debriefing.
Tainted warp coils.
Yeah, I mean, and we don't question that action exactly, but there's some questions raised about the things that happened during the mission to stop the Zindi from attacking Earth. And I think that was really fair, and I think that was really good that Star Trek offered an episode like that where hard questions were getting asked. I don't think we do that a lot in the Star Trek universe, where we get to actually see that, okay, actions were taken and hard questions are being asked. And
I don't know. Admiral Sati had some hard questions for Captain Picard.
Yeah, she's taken down bigger men than him, so... But I think that in the end, the mission was a success. So whatever actions Archer had to take aren't necessarily okay, but you know the overall outcome was good. So we're going to ask some questions, and we're going to maybe frown on some actions that were taken, but there are no real consequences for Captain Archer for the actions that he took. And so the mission was deemed a success. I think the same can be said of knowledge. You know, the idea of knowledge being tainted, if you get the knowledge and the overall outcomes are good, if you gain knowledge that saves lives, if you're able to cure a disease, if you're able to solve some, you know, humanitarian atrocity, then oftentimes we are willing to overlook missteps or questionable actions that are taken to get there. And some people would say, well, you know, that just doesn't seem right. And I think that's fair to, I think it's fair to say, I think that's a fair observation. I think that it's important to question actions and try to ensure that in the case of the Prime Directive, as we watched Enterprise, we got an understanding that there's a reason why we have the Prime Directive. It's because there were occasions when missteps were taken and we overstepped our bounds. We went into places and we interfered with the development of cultures in ways that perhaps weren't beneficial. And so at some point in time, although we don't really get to see that, sometime between Enterprise and the original series, we have this Prime Directive. And we understand why that's there. It's to prevent missteps from being taken along the way in the journey.
I still think that the fundamental distinction, though, is the difference between knowledge being valuable in principle versus all the pragmatic consequences and the pragmatic things associated with it. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of Krol Maset that we talked about, I think you could still say that knowledge is intrinsically valuable. It's worthwhile to know it, you know, regardless of how it came to be, regardless of what processes and what atrocities were committed to achieve the knowledge. Once the knowledge exists, it's valuable. But then we have to kind of let our pragmatic minds kick in again and ask, well, okay, given this knowledge and given that it's kind of dangerous, you know, if we pursue this path and use this knowledge, then future bad effects could ensue. Other scientists might, you know, feel justified in committing atrocities in the name of research and so on. What then? You know, we should put limits on that. We should limit its access. We shouldn't use it. We shouldn't tell people about it. All these pragmatic things, all for the sake of preventing future harm to other people. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that is in direct contradiction with saying that the knowledge itself is intrinsically valuable just because you're putting pragmatic checks on its application.
Sure. And I wonder, Zachary, what seventh season B'Elanna Torres would say about Janeway's decision to use that knowledge in order to save her. We know at the end of that episode, she's bitter, she's angry, and feels that Janeway in some ways violated her own rights. And I just wonder if the passing of time changes her attitudes about that. Does, you know, getting married and having a child of her own, does that change her perspective?
I really kind of feel like Janeway would be totally justified in disregarding B'Elanna's wishes in this regard. She could just say, B'Elanna, I don't care what you think about the situation. I had the power to save your life and I took it, and your life is intrinsically valuable. So who cares what you think about whether I should have done this or should have done that, or whether the knowledge is tainted or not. I had a certain power. Your life is valuable. And so I used it. And that's the end of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I think Janeway would be totally justified in saying that.
Oh, I agree. And being that she is a captain who is given, among other things, the responsibility for the lives of every person on her vessel, I think she's completely justified. But, you know, to the question of B'Elanna's attitude, I'm not saying that B'Elanna was right or wrong. I'm just saying the fact was, and I think this would be true of many people, you know, she was not at all happy that knowledge that she felt was tainted was used to save her life. And again, I just wonder if through the passage of time, does her attitudes change about that? Does her perspective change as life unfolds for her, as she herself gains more knowledge and more experience? I mentioned having a child. I know for me, having a child of my own changed my perspectives about a lot of things, a great many things that I thought in my 20s, my perspectives have changed now that I'm a parent. And so, again, I think that's an interesting question. What does our attitudes about knowledge and the quest for knowledge, what happens to those attitudes and those opinions and those ideas over the passage of time through our own experiences?
Well, Mike, I hate to tell you this, But over on To the Journey, speaking of Voyager, we were talking about some things that haven't been released yet. And I have to tell you, this podcast microphone is now tainted. I just wanted to tell you after the fact that I have used the tainted microphone.
And you had no right to use that podcast microphone, Zachary.
I guess the notion that an object or an action or knowledge can be tainted in some way is a strange notion, that it somehow its value is related to its history and the circumstances surrounding it and all of these extraneous factors. If you strip away all that stuff, the knowledge is valuable. When you add all of that stuff back in, now we have the question of whether something can be tainted. And I'm really skeptical, because I think it ignores the distinction between intrinsic features of something and extrinsic or circumstantial features of something, right? My microphone, I sort of think, you know, what has been said into my microphone before, whatever it might have been, has nothing to do with the properties of this microphone, right? It's just a microphone. It's just a thing, right? So why is knowledge any different? Knowledge, if it's intrinsically valuable, if it has a certain, you know, we've talked about different ways that might be fleshed out, which is, you know, maybe not be terribly convincing, but if there's this notion that knowledge is intrinsically valuable, why should its history or its relation to other people, all of these extraneous, somewhat circumstantial factors, be related to how we perceive the value of the knowledge itself? I think it just ignores the distinction between intrinsic features and extrinsic or circumstantial features.
I just find it interesting that, and I'm going to use once again back to our original discussion about the space race, I find it interesting that it seems that we are less willing to take risks today. As we've added to our knowledge, as we have gotten better at launching massive balls of flammable liquids into the stratosphere with people strapped to the top of them, we have gotten more.
Sometimes we even play magic carpet ride when we do it.
Absolutely. And why not? I mean, hey, you know, if you are going to strap yourself to a flaming ball of flammable liquid,
I'd turn up the rock.
I would turn up magic. Yes, absolutely. Get me some Steppenwolf and let's rock.
But you were saying we've gotten less risky. We've gotten more conservative. We're playing it safe more than we used to. Is
that what you're saying? Sure. And that's true, Zachary. That's true, you know, not just of our space race, but I think by and large, as a species, we've gotten less risky. We are less tolerant of the loss of life. Military campaigns, medical science, we've gotten less tolerant of the consequences and the risks that are involved. I wonder if that's...
Well, I was reading... This is interesting because I was reading an article about this recently that basically said that we're living in the era that future historians will call the Great Peace, because we haven't had another world war. We've had little minor skirmishes. Yes, we've had terrorism, and there's some, you know, some number of lives have been lost as a result of those kinds of things. But if you look at the casualties in all of those things in the last 50 years compared to World War II or World War I, mm-hmm. or the great wars in times past, mm-hmm. you know, the number of casualties is minuscule compared to those great wars. And we've had 50, 60 some odd years now of this, right? And so, you know, yeah, we've gotten, you know, we have it good. We really do. You know, we don't have to take those great risks. We don't have to worry about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people dying from this, that, or the other thing. You know, yes, we still have genocide, and that's a huge problem. But generally, you know, things like wars, things like, you know, I mean, I look at the things my ancestor did, and fighting in the Civil War and fighting in World War I, fighting in World War II. That sounds really risky and scary and terrible to me. And it does. I mean, I have amazing respect for it, but I've never had to face something like that practically. So yeah, we kind of have it good. We live a fairly cushy existence compared, you know, on average compared to generations past.
And again, I don't ask that question. I know in asking that question, people probably wonder, you know, geez, does Morrison not value human life? Or that's not the case at all.
That would be a gross misreading of what you're saying.
Indeed, right? Indeed. I'm just making an observation and asking a question. And, you know, the observation is, yeah, you know, we are less willing, I think, today to take risks. And I wonder if there's a law of diminishing returns in regards to that. Are we going to come to a time where we say, okay, we're going to colonize Mars. Okay. Let's say we're going to colonize the moon, or we're going to colonize Mars. There's going to be tremendous risks in doing that. And we're probably going to make some mistakes along the way, but are we going to come to a place where we say, okay, the ends justify the means?
Well, I think there's this fundamental problem that we don't know what we don't know, right? You could say, yes, there's a law of diminishing returns. If we continue to explore, continue to take risks, that eventually we're not going to get any more return out of the risk, mm-hmm. right? We will have kind of maxed out all the benefits that we could achieve. And you could say that maybe this has happened inside the Star Trek universe. By the time Star Trek The Next Generation rolls around, yes, they can go explore yet another new world with some more aliens and some funny colored clothes, and they'll learn a little bit there. But what exactly is the benefit of doing yet another one of those, given the hundreds and thousands of planets that they've explored, right? You could say, what's the point at a certain point? But you don't know what you don't know, right? It's like, you know, you might discover the next cure for another plague. You might, you know, mm-hmm. discover this, you know, groundbreaking feature of you know, the natural world that allows you to, you know, travel even faster and explore even more things and learn even greater things that we can only imagine now, right?
We don't even need starships to.
I think that's the fundamental problem with exploration, is you don't know that, right? It's the unknown. And I think that this is the tantalizing part of exploring the unknown, right? We are intrigued by what we don't understand yet. So if there's something unknown, a world to be explored, something to be researched, somewhere we haven't been, you know, our drive is to say, I want to go there because I don't know. Yeah, it might be an enormous waste of time. There might be nothing, but you might discover dilithium, or you might discover nothing.
Nothing. Gold.
Nothing. Gold. More it's gold. Worthless. It's yes. Worthless. You might discover... Right. You might discover dilithium, but you might discover gold, which is worthless. But I guess my point is, you just don't know, right? That's the whole point of going there. We don't know what's there, and maybe it'll be a waste of time, but maybe it won't, right? We might learn something amazing and groundbreaking. We might, you know, meet new races that will be our best friends. We might meet our next worst nightmare of an enemy. We just don't know, right? But I think we humans can't resist going into the unknown, because we find that question tantalizing. Like, what is out there? We don't know, and we want to know. And yes, it's risky. Yes, we might get no returns, but we might. And the mere fact that it might be worth it causes us to be willing to take the risk, at least some of us, some of the time.
And I think that's, Zachary, inherently why we still are committed as a species to explore, to seek out life, to gain understanding, for lack of a better way to put it, to continue boldly going where no one's gone before.
And I still think there's something to this notion that it's humans in particular that do this, and maybe other, by extension, other sentient beings in the Star Trek universe, but not even all of those. Like, I don't think my pets have the greatest sense of exploration, right? they are totally content to lay here and be fed and be pet and be given attention. They don't seem to have this existential drive to go into the unknown. Although I do see some other cats patrolling the neighborhood, and they seem to have this, you know, ever expanding series of concentric circles that defines their territory. So maybe cats do explore. I don't really know, but I think humans in particular have an incredible drive to explore and understand the unknown, because we're bothered by our lack of understanding about our own place in the universe. And I think in the Star Trek universe, some other alien races have that to various degrees. Some are more warlike. Some are more like explorers. Some are totally content to hang out on their planet and enjoy the pleasures of their own planet. There's kind of a species quality to it. And I think that's definitely true of human beings. We are, as we said before, Aristotle's rational animal. We understand. And when we don't understand, we have this innate drive to increase our understanding. We can't resist a mystery.
I think for the animal kingdom, though, it's all about finding necessary resources, food, water.
It's not exploration or expanding into the unknown for its own sake.
You know, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about the difference between this very closed-minded ideology that sometimes we label science and the true, pure science that is this never-ending quest for truth. And I am really interested, and I love to read articles about that quest for truth, our own expansion of knowledge and understanding. And it fascinates me because it seems like every time I read something online, we've taken one more small step towards something like warp drive or, you know, transporter technology. I saw in last week's headlines that, you know, a company has recently developed something that is probably a precursor to the tricorder. And those things excite me. But it's only possible so long as we continue to respond to that drive, that innate drive that is within, I think, the human creature to expand, explore, and increase knowledge.
The distinction between a generally scientific society and an overly scientific, naive society is an interesting one. I mean, you made a distinction between real science and kind of pseudoscience or naive science, where one is concerned with genuine truth and genuine knowledge, mm-hmm. And the other is concerned with an agenda, right? And I make no claims about what falls in what category.
Truly.
Yeah, truly. I think that there's a naive scientism where you can say that, you know, science will solve all of our problems and any other feature of human existence, you know, religion, mythology, mm-hmm. art, ethics, philosophy, whatever it is subjugated to science. I think that would be a scientism as opposed to
sure.
science, you know, some sort of science in some pure sense. And Star Trek could very easily devolve into naive scientism. It's technological, it's progressive, it is, you know, it does seem concerned with knowledge as an intrinsic value. But yet Star Trek is interesting because it doesn't let science devolve into scientism, mm-hmm. right? They are concerned with the ethical implications of science. And they do play violin and have string quartets on the Enterprise D. and Star Trek never prioritizes science over other things that matter to a human life and human existence, where it could very easily just be all about science for its own sake and exploration. And if we step on anyone's toes in the name of science, so be it. I mean, you could imagine that there's a tempt, especially in a technological society like you see in the 23rd and 24th centuries in the Star Trek universe. Why not do that, right? You have all this power, these starships at your command. You can learn anything you want. But humans at that point have kind of evolved, to use Gene Roddenberry's terms, into a being that is able to keep the ethical considerations front and center in consideration and not let the other important features of human existence get weeded out in the name of science.
Zachary, I think that was incredibly well said. I think it's important to say that in the Star Trek universe, I think that the overall idea is that science is important, but so are the arts, so is philosophy, and yes, even faith has a place in humanity, and I think that's important. These things are all intrinsically important to us, and all add to our overall knowledge and our ability to understand the universe around us and to understand humanity and understand other species that we come in contact with, you know, to really gain knowledge and to gain understanding. All of these things, be it science, be it philosophy, be it religion, be it whatever, these all play an important role in the balance of humanity.
I think for me, there's kind of a two-pronged approach to my final thoughts. One is that I think we as Star Trek fans in general are not always very critical of the assumptions that underlie our generally optimistic, progressive, scientific, knowledge-based worldview. You know, we don't often ask those deeper questions like, is that knowledge really valuable enough to justify, you know, spending all the resources and continuing to step out into the unknown when we don't even know what the result will be? We might get some great benefits, but we might not, right? So that's one question, like, you know, what exactly grounds our worldview when we ask those critical questions, right? Because you don't want this worldview that we all find very appealing to be a house of cards. And I kind of worry that it might be for some people, that it's it's appealing. But when you kind of ask, well, why is it important exactly? Well, then you're kind of firmly in the realm of these practical considerations. Like, you might get great benefits, you might solve medical problems and social problems, but you might not, right? You know, those things might continue to plague mankind as long as we exist as a species. I think, you know, Star Trek does present an optimistic view of that we'll actually solve these problems and end up being progressive, but that might not happen. We don't know. You can't predict the future, right? So for me, the challenge is to try to ground the justification for the Star Trek universe and its view that knowledge is somehow intrinsically valuable in something that's genuinely intrinsic, not subject to these potential outcomes that may or may not come to fruition or the benefits that may or may not happen, right? We don't really know any of that. We're taking a risk at every turn, every time we step into the unknown, or every time we try to learn something new, every time we, you know, get out of our comfort zone, every time we explore a new planet inside the Star Trek universe, right? That's a risk every time. So if you're placing the value of that quest on the end result, you might often be disappointed. So I guess the question for me is, well, what exactly does ground that intrinsic quest for knowledge then, if it's not all these practical, instrumental benefits that may or may not happen? And we've talked about some of those today. It might be, you know, us being the fullest version of ourselves. It's some sort of species authenticity. Certainly, it seems virtuous to step out into the unknown. But I think it's a very, very hard question to know why exactly that quest for knowledge is valuable enough, even if none of those benefits come to fruition. And I think this is, you know, me being the skeptical Star Trek fan here, right? I would love to see the kind of future that you see in the Star Trek universe come to fruition. Practically speaking, it might never actually happen, right? Sure. There are certain features of human nature that work against that, and we have to constantly overcome those intuitions. But I wouldn't want to say that my justification for stepping out into the unknown or exploring or seeking to better myself or seeking to increase my knowledge is contingent on whether or not those benefits actually come to pass, right? There's something valuable in the moment in doing those things that's intrinsically valuable, whether or not any of those consequences come. But it's also very difficult to kind of precisely philosophically state what that value is. And I hope we've given some different approaches to that today.
Sure. You know, to kind of answer my initial question at the beginning of the episode, that question of what business do we have traipsing around the galaxy? I think for me,
I'm in the Latinum business. I don't know about you.
the benefits, and yes, the instrumental benefits, because I truly believe that out there in the galaxy are potential cures for disease. I think the knowledge that we gain and the benefits to humanity are worth those risks. I'm one of those people. And yes, we've learned from, you know, thousands of years of existence that innately we are explorers. We are constantly exploring what is around us. We are constantly on a quest to add to our knowledge. We've been doing it since the first time, you know, man wielded fire, and we've just gone from there to exploring the oceans and exploring the skies and exploring, nearly unreachable corners of our own planet. And we've put humans on the moon, and, you know, we brought back rocks, and we're sending probes. And so for me, it's risky business, not to be confused with the Tom Cruise movie from way back when, but it's risky business. And
I guess I'm more intrigued by our insatiability than by what we might find, right? You know, we're going to go to Mars someday.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in our lifetimes, maybe not. I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. It hasn't happened yet. If it happens in our lifetime and we get there and we find out that, hey, it is a lifeless lump of red rock, right? You know, what will we do? Will we go back to Earth and go, man, that sucked. Let's never do that again. We might do that for a while, 10 years, 50 years.
Sure.
But, you know, eventually we're going to go, let's go on to the next one, you know, let's go explore the asteroid belt, or let's go to Jupiter or something, right? You know, we'll just keep, you know, we're insatiable. Even if we're disappointed, we go, yeah, we'll sulk and we'll kind of go, yeah, it wasn't worth it. Look at all this money we spent, and maybe some lives were lost along the way. But eventually that feeling of exploration, this impulse will arise again. and we'll go, what's next? On to the next adventure. And I think we're just insatiable. We just keep coming back for more, even if we're disappointed at every turn.
Yeah. And unless 46 years from now, some Vulcans land, I think it's going to be a long haul.
Well, I mean, we were disappointed when we got to the moon. Let's be honest.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We thought we would find something interesting when we got there. Turns out, yes, we've learned some things. We've learned some things about the moon's relationship to the Earth and how the planets
and the moon
was formed. It's not
made of cheese.
It's not made of, you know, we have learned some interesting things, you know, and we're continuing to learn things, but largely it's a lifeless lump of mineral, right? There's nothing interesting there when it comes down to it. Despite anything we might learn about the natural world, and we're disappointed. And so we sulked for a while, and now we're kind of steadily creeping towards going to Mars. You know, we're not really running towards it. We're kind of crawling towards it, but there's an impulse there. And, you know, even if we're disappointed, you know, it might set us back a few years, but that impulse will keep stirring. And I just find that fascinating. I find that more interesting than whatever we actually learn in getting there.
All I know is that, whenever we go back there, we're in luck. 'Cause there's, you know, there's already a car there to drive around and explore some more. So hopefully that was a sign of things to come, that we're not done exploring, because I do think that despite the disappointment of the moon, I still think there is knowledge there to be gained. And, you know, even if it's the knowledge to get to the next step, sometimes that's the end.
I guess ultimately my point is that it just doesn't matter, right? We might learn nothing, but we can't resist going anyway.
Yeah.
And that says more about us than about knowledge, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do. I think you're right.
I mean, that's the whole mission statement of Star Trek in general, to boldly go where no one has gone before, right? It doesn't matter what's there. No, it's not like we're going to boldly go as long as we'll find something interesting. That's not what it says.
Well, I think that was the original statement. And then, you know,
got edited, tweaked a little bit.
Roddenberry sent it to the editing room and, you know, they cut it down for time's sake. But I got to keep this thing under a certain length of time. You know how it goes.
That's awesome. To boldly go as long as we find something interesting.
As long as we find something interesting.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about being disappointed in our exploration of the Star Trek universe, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
That's not to take away anything that they are. They have the same standard of excellence. They are as brilliant, as smart. They're good leaders, but they're guys who go home. They're guys who drink. They're guys who go to the bar. They're guys who get in fistfights. They're, you know, guys who have wives and argue, and they're guys who deal with loss.
To the journey!
I've just got this vision now of Janeway there. Who's a good Voyager? Who's a good girl?
Well, she liked to, you know, stroke the halls and everything.
So Tom Paris would be like, who's a good girl? You want to go for a ride? Let's go.
Literary Treks.
I'm glad we reread this, because at the time I did read this, it was when the new movie was out. But now that we've had the three movies, as you just mentioned, and I've seen Star Trek 09 about 100 times, I'm very familiar with the movie and not as much as with the comic now, because I've only read it maybe a couple of times.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. And you can now also find us on YouTube and Google Play Music as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. Well, if you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, be sure to check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. This is our listeners only discussion group. It is a closed group, but if you click join, one of our admins will let you right on in.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not busy exploring a worthless lump of rock, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Catch me in the Babel Conference from time to time. Love to talk to you about Star Trek and philosophy there. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. You can also check out my blog, where I'm talking about my journey to publish a book and a little bit about life. That is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not running around with your hair on fire trying to break speed records, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's show dedicated to everything related to Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our three associate producers here from MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find him under the Twitter handle @MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, my co-host over on To the Journey. You can find her under the handle @ChocoWeeble. And our newest associate producer, Kit Lofstadt. You can find her under the Twitter handle @MotherCat. And that is mother with a zero. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before, even if it's a worthless lump of rock.